This is the CineSnob Podcast.
Welcome to episode 212 of the CineSnob Podcast. I'm Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody Viafania.
Cody, it is the 5th of July, but it is the officially observed holiday for the 4th of July. We're off today. It always kind of feels like you're kind of getting away with thing. I don't know if you feel the same way. Like
today?
Yeah, like the holiday's over. Like 4th of July, I mean, it's never been like a, you know, big family gathering time for me.
Yeah.
Not like a Christmas or a Thanksgiving or whatever. So like getting the day off after it's already passed already seems like, okay. I mean, it's cool that it happens. It's just,
I mean, better to happen on the Monday or a Friday if it's going to happen and just lead to a long weekend instead of it being, you know, like a middle of a Tuesday or Wednesday off. So
true.
You know, I'll take it.
True. Yeah. I did get my first, I don't want to say post-pandemic because we're not quite there yet, but my first, like, going out of the pandemic sickness.
Yeah.
This weekend. Like, a good old-fashioned cold.
Mm.
And, I mean, nothing like it. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah, they're the best.
You know, I started feeling shitty this past week, and, you know, we got our vaccination. We've been fully vaccinated for a couple months now. So I went and actually scheduled a COVID test, one of the rapid tests, and it's terribly unpleasant, sticking that thing up your nose. And when it came back negative, I was like, oh, look at that. A good old fashioned, just a cold or
common,
whatever.
Common cold.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go to the doctor for it because they're not going to tell me to do anything else. You know, they're going to be like, well, you got a cold, you're good.
Yeah, we have more important things to worry about right now.
So, I've just been resting, and it's been fun. Good times.
That sounds like a blast.
Yeah, you know, my ears are all fucked up. I can't hear quite well at this point because of the sinuses, I guess. But one of the weirdest things happened to me for the first time ever. Like, I blew my nose yesterday. And it screwed up my ears and it made me super dizzy. I was like, oh man, I am nice and old now.
Yeah, that's an old man move right there.
Yeah.
The blowing out your back or whatever from sneezing, that kind of thing.
I've thrown my back out, I think, 3 times total in my life. The first one came from lifting a barbecue pit. So that was like, that's how I earned my stripes. The second time came when I was adjusting a blanket on the couch. And then the third one was loading some dog food into the car. So,
yeah. That sounds about right.
I'm done with the back. It's just a matter of time before it's gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Before you slip a disc.
Oh, God. I don't want to do that. That's one of the things that horrifies me. Anyway, but it doesn't keep me from lifting dog food or whatever crap else that I have to pick up. So
yeah, you're still a manly dude who can lift a bag of dog food.
Look, Cody, I have to take care of my family, and the dogs need premium Alpo chicken cutlets or whatever the fuck is in says on the side of the dog food. It looks like a stew. I don't know.
Well, speaking of family, we missed the F9, the opportunity to talk F9.
We did. You actually saw it. I didn't. I am not a big Fast and Furious guy. Cody, I know that's your culture. You know, you come from a street racing family.
Yes.
And
I think, you know, it just kind of speaks to me. I can see myself at the end of the barbecue at the end of every Fast and Furious movie. And we all came from a long stories of boosting DVD players, you know, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it's all about that barbecue at the end and, you know, turning enemies into friends. You know, even the guy that, you know, murdered apparently the other part of your crew and you turned them into a fan, a part of your family.
Yeah.
you know, and don't forget to invite your dead best friend's, sorry, your retired best friend's wife over and maybe leave him behind.
Well, he was watching the kids. That's an F9. He's watching the kids.
Yeah.
So he can't make it.
You know, that's one of the things that really bothers me. Because Furious 7? Yeah, Furious 7, the Paul Walker's last movie.
Yeah, I think it's 7.
They make a huge deal about, you know, and rightly so. He died in the production of the film. They make a big deal about, like, retiring that character forever. Mm-hmm. As they should. You know, it's this is a guy that was in most of the movies, if not, I think he only missed one.
I think just Tokyo Drift, which was the one that, like, none of them were in.
Well, Vin Diesel was at in epilogue for that or something. Yeah. But anyway, and then you tell me this one, then this film, they like bring him back off screen.
Yeah.
Like they bring back whatever his name is, Brian something. I don't know what his last name is in the movie.
Yeah. For spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen F9, but the movie ends like, so basically, his sister pops back into the movie to help him out because John Cena's playing their brother. And
Jordana Brewster,
yeah. And so they say that Brian is watching both their kids and then Dom and Letty's kid as well. And then at the end, it ends with the barbecue like it always does. And they're saying, and then someone says something like, we can't get started yet. And then you hear like an engine revving and then some like, you know, Honda Civic with a spoiler or whatever pulls up into the parking lot and then it just fades to black. So that character's not only alive, but they were teasing he showed up to the barbecue and stuff. So
why can't I don't understand that. Why can't they just like leave him be?
I don't know. I mean, my theory is that they're going to bring one of his brothers, like Paul Walker's real life brothers, back and some sort of storyline to close everything out. But
you think that they'll bring one of his brothers in to play him again?
Either play him or play Paul Walker's brother inside the universe. So like Brian has a secret brother and then they bring back Paul Walker's brother. Some bullshit like that. There's got to be a reason they won't close the door on that thing.
That's really it's really disappointing too, because for the cheesiness of the films, I think they did a really, you know, did a really nice goodbye to the character in Furious 7. And then,
yeah, it was about as respectful and as much of a tribute as you probably can get. And it also didn't seem gratuitous or sort of like in poor taste the way in which they, you know, digitally recreated him or whatever. But
right. And, you know, they had his brothers involved. And
well, and they've like already said, and Justin Lin said in an interview that he's not opposed to bringing that character back for the last two movies. So I really do think that they're going to do something involving, you know, bringing him back to life in some way, which, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care anything about those movies, and it's one of those things that I
So I was going to tell you this off mic, but I'll just tell you to give us some fodder here.
Uh-huh.
So I saw one of the movies we're talking about today, Zola, in a theater because my screener expired before I could get to it. Okay. And they were playing the trailers beforehand, and it was all the same shit, like, you know, M. Night Shyamalan's old and Candyman. Mm-hmm. And then the last trailer they showed was Greenland, a movie that came out like a year ago.
Huh.
And I'm like, are they re-releasing it in theaters or something?
Are they? I don't know. I mean, that's a weird thing.
It was very weird. I was like, what the fuck's going on here? And as far as I can tell, I mean, they announced the sequel, but as far as I can tell, they're not re-releasing it in theaters. So I don't know how that one snuck in, but it was very strange. Also, two old white people walked out like 15 minutes into Zola.
I could see that, yeah. They probably didn't know what they were getting.
No, and if not, then they would have had plenty of other chances, but we'll get into that in a bit.
Yeah.
But I did find that kind of funny. Like, they 15 minutes and they split.
which theater was this? Was this one of your usual Santikos Embassy?
No, this was Northwoods.
Oh, so okay.
Not too far.
Still seems like a... you know, and maybe I'm still thinking of this as a pre-pandemic thing, but Zola seems like a weird choice to play at a theater like that, because it's very much not an art house movie, but it is very particular. The audience is very particular, I think, for it.
It is. I think we're still in the phase, though, where they're just trying to fill screens with movies. Yeah. So, you know, some of the smaller, like, I mean, I think Zola is playing at every Santikos theater in town right now,
which that would not have been the case in, you know, 2019.
Yeah, and Zola's also at Huebner and Quarry and all of the Regal places too. So it's just, I mean it's benefiting from a wider release, but yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that soon. Anything else before we move on?
I don't think so. I think we can go ahead and move on and we're you know, this is going to be an interesting next few months, really, because we're in the first bounce back summer of the pandemic, and it'll be interesting to see the performance. Obviously, F9 did a buku box office while we were out, and I'm interested to see what Black Widow does next week, especially with the Disney premiere access. So,
okay, let's go ahead and move on to reviews then.
Here are this week's reviews.
First up, we have The Tomorrow War.
There are 50 to 60 armed men and women standing on the pitch.
You're tapped in.
Good copy. It's okay. We are you. 30 years in the future.
It's okay, sweetie.
We are fighting a war. Our enemy is not human. And we are losing. In 11 months' time, all human beings in the future will be wiped from the face of the earth. Unless you help us.
This is a sci-fi thriller starring Chris Pratt, as you saw briefly there. Another of the another in a line of Paramount films that were sold to Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
As this premiered on Amazon Prime this past weekend. Cody, tell us about The Tomorrow War and what you thought of it.
Yeah, so this was originally supposed to be a movie that came out Christmas last year through Paramount, and then Paramount sold it to Amazon, and now it's Amazon only. It's not even showing theatrically anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a hard movie to describe without getting into spoiler territory, I think. It's a little bit hard to describe anyway, because I think it's a bit of a mess. But you know, essentially you have, you know, like you saw in that clip there, there is some people come from the future into present day and kind of say, hey, we're in a war that we're losing, and we need people to come with us into the future to help us fight the war. And Chris Pratt plays like a teacher who's ex-military, who sort of gets drafted to go to the future. So basically the way that they're having the, I believe they said that like people volunteered first, and then they had to start drafting people to go to the future to fight the war. And, you know, it's rounded out with a cast of, there's a lot of, you know, great actors in it. You have, you know, J.K. Simmons has a small role. Betty Gilpin you saw in there. Yvonne Strahovski, Sam Richardson, a good cast. And it, like you said, it is kind of a sci-fi thriller. And I have to say that the conceit of the movie, the idea of it, I think, is relatively clever. I like the idea of sort of having to fight a war in the future that you're completely unaware of. In the present, I don't want to give this plot point away specifically, but there is an element of how they are drafting in the certain people that are being selected that I actually think is like a smart, interesting idea that they do nothing with.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's one of the things I was going to mention. Is it's one of those things that you're like, when you hear about it, you're like, oh, okay, and then it just nothing ever comes of it.
Right. And you're exactly right. Because when I saw that, I'm like, okay, I actually like that idea a lot. And then it just kind of fizzles. you know, beyond that, I actually think that the first 45 minutes or so of this movie is actually pretty fun. Because it features, you know, you get to know Chris Pratt's character, and then, you know, you see him in training and you see him meet, you know, Sam Richardson, who I think is probably the MVP of the movie. I think Sam Richardson is really funny in here. I think basically everything he says makes me laugh. And really, if you've seen Sam Richardson in anything ever, you know what you're getting, you know, very similar to like his Veep character and stuff like that. And I think that the way that it treats like, you know, going into the future for the first time and kind of fighting the beginning part, I found to be pretty fun and entertaining. And then the second act feels like it is stripped from a different movie. I know we say that all the time, how some things, you know, feel like separate movies or something like that, or stitched together or put together in reshoots. But man, this movie essentially becomes a two-hander with Pratt and Ivan Strahovski in the middle chunk of the movie. Now, is all of that bad? No, I think there's some emotional elements that work. I think in particular, Ivan Strahovski's, it has some like really great moments of acting and performance. But it feels completely separate from the first act of the movie, which leads you to a third act that feels, again, completely separate. You know, you have characters, you know, the characters played by Sam Richardson and Edwin Hodge and J.K. Simmons, who just are absent from the middle of this movie. Like, you know, every supporting character is absent in the middle of the movie, and then they just sort of magically return for the final act. And by that point, the movie's a mess. The logic of everything is messy. The way in which it's sort of playing hard and playing loose with its time travel rules is messy. You know, certain they start to do certain things where you're like, why weren't they doing that from the get-go? You know, like there's some emotional weight that's pulled having to do with Chris Pratt's character, where it's like, okay, well, this probably didn't matter as much in the moment as they're making it out to be. And I just wonder how much of this movie was reshot and stitched together. Because so I'm one of the actors in there is Mike Mitchell from the Doughboys podcast, which is my favorite podcast. And, you know, he was in Atlanta for like 5 months shooting this movie. And he's in the movie for like,
holy shit, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And he's in the movie for like 5 minutes. Like his role is not that big, but he was there for a long time. And, went through boot camp and did a bunch of different stuff. So, you know, I wonder how much of this, because it almost feels like the first act was the movie and then they stuck in that middle section for more emotional weight. And maybe there was something more. I don't know. I would be very interested to see what like the first draft of this script looked like. Because again, they did, you know, they changed the title of the movie and they did go in for reshoots and stuff. But anyway, all that being said, I think that it takes an interesting premise and just sort of fumbles it. And, you know, I think it's mixed with some kind of, again, occasionally weak CGI. And I think that by the end of it, I was just like, okay, I don't care about any of this anymore, because you've taken an interesting idea and now you're, you know, it's just such a hodgepodge of like futuristic alien apocalyptic movies, where it's like they just kind of throw in different generic story beats, and you're left with kind of this jumbled mess of a thing that started off promising.
You know, yeah, I don't have a lot more to add to that. You kind of hit everything that I was talking about when you mentioned the things that they kind of ignore their own rules and this stuff kind of becomes inconsequential. You know, I want to go back to that second act, because it really is strange, because there is a section in that where you have Chris Pratt's character just literally parceled out from the rest of the film that he was in, to spend time with Ivan Strahovski's character, which is not a bad decision. And I don't think the film is bad in that part, but it is strange, and this started out as some sort of like ensemble piece, because the premise here is that these are regular people that get drafted. You know, they're not, you know, for lack of spoiling a plot point, you know, they're not military people, and they're, you know, they have a certain characteristic that they share that, you know, they get thrown into this, you know, really quick, intensive boot camp, and they're supposed to go fight this war for a week in the future and then maybe come back. But then the middle of the movie isn't really concerned with that at all. It's more concerned with, separating Chris Pratt with Yvonne Strahovski, and they conduct like scientific experiments, you know, before, excuse me, there's the sickness coming in, before going back to, God damn it. Sorry. Anyway. Yeah, I don't have a lot to say, but yeah, that's the biggest point of the movie that I thought was this is how it's going to go. Sorry. the biggest thing about the movie that I thought was irritating was that it abandoned the premise that it set up, you know, that it's like these people from the past have to go fight this war in the future. And then it seems to go off in a different direction, like sort of standard action movie fare in the middle, mm-hmm. and then comes back to that ensemble at the end. So, like you said, there must have been something in there that didn't work, that was reshot or reconfigured in some way, because it just doesn't really flow at all.
Yeah, and I think that you get, you know, that ensemble piece is where it starts to feel like a bit of a throwback action film where, you know, you have your team of people who are, you know, your team of misfits, and you have your different people and so on and so forth. And to completely, and I don't mean like, you know, it changed like the story, it just completely leaves behind that story, and goes into a completely separate direction. Again, like I said, on its own, that separate direction, not terrible.
Yeah.
But also not the same movie that you were just watching, which is jarring to say the least.
Yeah, and then, you know, by the end of it, you know, you've got this ragtag team of people kind of working together on their own, which, again, doesn't square with the rest of the movie in that, you know, this is like this massive effort from the future to help save the future by going to the past.
Yeah.
It, again, you're thinking, well, why didn't they try this before? You know, why didn't this work before? Mm-hmm. It's I don't think it's bad, and I don't think it's a total misfire, but I think that there's just a lot of stuff that really cripples the movie along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah. What's your grade for the Tomorrow War?
I gotta give it a C. I was close to a C plus, but the last act of the movie, the way in which things fall apart, and especially with what it started with and what the premise was, I feel like is just a big whiff. So yeah,
I'm gonna go C+. I think it's decent enough. It doesn't really go to the recommendation pile for me, but I think there are worse ways that this thing could have gone, and I'm thankful it didn't. I wish it would have been better. You know, they're going to keep trying to throw Chris Pratt these franchises that don't depend on the franchise strength. Maybe one of them will stick someday, or maybe he'll just be the guy that be like Robert Downey Jr. that just goes and cashes Marvel's checks for
yeah,
the rest of his life. All right, let's move on to our next movie, Summer of Soul.
Are you ready, black people? Are you ready? Are you really ready? Are you ready to listen to all the beautiful black voices, the beautiful black feeling, the beautiful black waves moving in beautiful air? Are you ready, black people? Are you ready?
Nobody ever heard of the Harlem Culture Festival. Nobody would believe it happened.
Six weekends of major artists.
The Panthers were the security and kids were sitting up on the trees.
I was nervous.
I didn't expect a crowd like that. Something very important was happening. It wasn't just about the music.
1969 was a change of era in the black community.
The styles were changing.
Music was changing.
And revolution was coming together.
We are a new people. We are a beautiful people.
You know, I got to say one thing real quick. Thank you to Hulu for putting clips of this film on EPK TV, which is where I get the clips for this film. But they only put musical performances, which are beautifully shot and sound amazing. They're going to get me flagged. They're going to get us flagged on YouTube. We can't put those up because it's just YouTube's going to be like, you got a song in there. Sorry. So I had to pull this trailer. But anyway, this is a musical documentary directed by Questlove, of course, from The Roots. You see him on Jimmy Fallon pretty much everywhere. He was the DJ for the Oscars this year. Cody, tell us about Summer of Soul and what you thought of it.
Yeah, so I'll kind of give you the bulk of this because I have not seen this in 6 months. I watched this Sundance back in January, where it won, kind of swept the documentary categories, and so essentially it's a documentary about the Harlem Culture Festival, which happened in 1969, the same year as Woodstock happened. It happened over the course of six weekends, and it sort of was a, kind of like a. I mean, it was a music festival, yes, but it was also a signifying moment in history that kind of really was representing, black culture, black music, in a bit of a tense time in New York. As they kind of described in the film. And so I think the most important characteristic of this documentary is that this footage was all shot professionally and then sat in a warehouse or whatever for, 40 years, and nobody had ever seen it before. And so right off the bat, Questlove is given a gold mine, and it's hard to mess up, I think, this treasure trove of unseen footage that's all really great. And you have performances from Stevie Wonder and Sly and the Family Stone and Gladys Knight and the Pips and, a lot of different, I think B.B. King is in there,
mm-hmm.
Nina Simone. You have a lot of great musical performances. And I think the Questlove benefits from two things. One, he benefits from great footage, and two, he benefits from the idea that the performers that were there, much of them are still alive, and they're able to also watch the movie, the footage for the first time in 40 years, and mm-hmm. comment on it and talk about what it was like for them. And I think it's probably more than 40 years. I don't know why I keep saying 40 years. It's probably
it's 50. It's 50. 69 is 52 years ago.
Yeah, and so. And so you have, and I think there's a great balance here of musical performance and commentary, people talking about what it was like, introducing the musical performances, contextualizing it. And again, just the way that, it was very professionally shot. So it sound, like you said, it sounds amazing. It looks amazing. It's like a multi-camera shoot. Like it's like, there's just a lot going on and a lot.
Shot on film too. Like mm-hmm. it was. Of course, the Woodstock concert was shot on film too, famously, and released as a film. But this was not. So
yeah, and I think I would be. I'm sure there's going to be a criterion of this someday with it's just loaded with musical performances and stuff like that. But for now, I think it's a great summary. Where, like I said, it's a good balance between interview and it's a good balance of music. And I think that like I said, it's hard to mess up footage this great, but I think that Questlove does a good job of kind of shepherding the footage, creating the interviews from it, creating a narrative out of it, and it's just really enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to watch, and I think one of my favorite moments was when you see Fifth Dimension come out to sing Aquarius mm-hmm. / Let the Sunshine In. And the idea, like Marilyn McCoo talking about how no one really thought they were black mm-hmm. hearing that song. I mean, it did come from the musical Hair, and they recorded a version of it. But just the idea that she was that they were surprised when there was a black woman singing, a black, entirely black, five black people singing in Fifth Dimension. One of the things that I thought was most interesting was the idea that it was shot for some sort of release. And I wish the movie had gone into this more. It's the one kind of disappointing thing I have about the film. Thing I have about the film is, you know, this was shot for release. It's in some form or fashion. And they don't really ever, they say that, you know, whoever the producer is talks in a voiceover near the end that no one wanted to buy it because it was a black quote festival. I just feel like I wish that story was explored more, like why it sat around for over 50 years before being discovered, you know, because these are all like legendary performers that they're interviewing. I don't know who else filled out those other weeks, people that maybe you don't know, or maybe that aren't as recognizable, but you've got Stevie Wonder in there. You've got the Gladys Knight and the Pips, again, Fifth Dimension, Sly and the Family Stone, B.B. King, the Chambers Brothers, just all kinds of these legendary 60s acts. Like you said, that a lot of them are still alive. I feel like there might be more of a story, and if there's not, then there's not. I just feel like there might be more of a story as to why this thing just sat around unreleased.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if maybe the significance of that moment wasn't necessarily, you know, was kind of lost on the people at the time, because this was, if you listen to the part of the film talks about this being the third annual version of this Harlem Cultural Festival. So I wonder if, you know, if there was something that made people think that this was just not special, you know, other than the, you know, the implied, and not implied, but stated kind of racial bias toward the performers. But that's kind of a fascinating thing to me. Like, this thing was produced out so well, you know, it's not widescreen like the Woodstock film is, but it is shot very well. And the sound recording is almost impeccable.
Yeah.
For the time. And, you know, I feel like there's maybe some other story as to why this just was not released. Not some other story, but a deeper story that I'd like to know more about.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great movie, and I think there's not really a lot to say about it other than if you love musical documentaries, I think this is one of the better ones I've seen in a while. You know, it's almost full performances from these groups too. Mm-hmm. Like, it just,
yeah, they really let the performances breathe, which I appreciate. You know, like I said. You've got to really contextualize it, and I think that they do a good job of allowing that. And I loved hearing the people like reflect back on seeing that footage for the first time. You know, and kind of reflecting, and like you said, that Fifth Dimension anecdote about that moment in time. You know, you would like if it was just the concert footage, you would never understand that piece of it. And I think it's a great addition to the footage.
And one thing I thought was interesting is one day of the festival took place like during the moon landing, the first moon landing.
Yeah.
And there's people they're talking to people like, which do you think, like, they're saying like, well, this is more important to me than the moon landing. Like, I don't care what the
just,
moon landing.
Just the lack of care in it. Yeah. That was very funny. Yeah.
Anyway, what's your grade for, Summer of Soul?
I'm giving Summer of Soul a B+.
Yeah, I think myself too, a B+. It's really enjoyable, and you know, I think like you mentioned, the context to go with these performances is really what makes it. You know, if it was just the music, it'd be great, but I think, you know, the context behind everything really drives it home. It's available now on Hulu if you want to watch it. All right, let's move on to our next movie, Zola.
Hey. Last month, I went dancing at this cute spot in Florida where my roommate's girl made like 5 G's a night. Because of
my birthday. We just met yesterday and you already trying to take whole trips together?
Be ready by 2.
Hi, bitch!
You want to hear a story about how me and this bitch fell out? It's kind of long, but it's full of suspense.
You want to go somewhere with me?
That's my place. Shut it so bad.
Dear Heavenly Father, we are asking you a special prayer today. We asking you to send us niggas. Yes. Send us niggas with culture. Send us niggas with good credit.
What brings y'all here?
We make ish money.
Money, titties, money, titties.
From here on out, watch every move this bitch makes.
nappy ass hair was up in my face.
Word.
This is a film based on a Twitter thread from 2015. Cody, were you familiar with this story at all before this film?
I was not.
I'm not that online to have been part of this.
Yeah.
But apparently this was based on a Twitter thread by the titular Zola in 2015 about how she went on this adventure. But now it's a film from A24. Cody, you saw some old people walk out on this, mm-hmm, but tell me what you thought of Zola.
Yeah, so like you said, it is adapted from a 148-tweet Twitter thread about how basically the main character, Zola, in the movie meets a stripper, and they go on a road trip to Florida, and then sort of craziness ensues. You know, this is very much a, you know, it's an A24 distributed movie, and it feels like that. You know, it's really energetic. You know, the filmmaking is sort of like that kind of, in my opinion, kind of like the ADD filmmaking of like a lot of, you know, random stuff and a lot of changes in visual styles and a lot of change in like big narrative shifts or perspective shifts. And I think the thing that you know, I'll start with the thing that I think works, which I think are the performances are all pretty good. I think in particular, Riley Keough is good in this role too. I think she's good in mostly everything I've ever seen her in, but this is a very different performance for her. I think that Taylor Page is good as well, and I like Colman Domingo. Nicholas Braun, I'm not quite sure about. I think he served his purpose, but Nicholas Braun kind of has one gear. you know, I don't know if you seen Succession?
I haven't seen Succession, no. And this, we've got two big Succession actors this week, and I need to catch up with it. I need to watch it.
It's great, and Nicholas Braun is great in Succession, but it's you know, again, he has kind of one gear. But look, I mean, I think if anything, this movie sort of proves why adapting a movie from a Twitter thread is maybe not the best idea. Because to me, it's like hearing someone tell a story that they think is crazy, but ends up not being so crazy. I actually think that I was waiting for like this, you know, I'm waiting for like an hour for this story to kind of kick in a little bit. And I don't know that it ever does. And I don't know that it ever reaches the heights of craziness that, that is sort of promised by its premise. I think when I went to lunch after I watched the movie and I sat there like reading the Twitter thread and I read to like 2/3 of it. And I think, you know, the idea behind the Twitter thread that was crazy is that this woman is recounting a story and she's the audience of it. So she's, you know, watching it observe. She's commenting on how crazy things are. And in the movie, I think the big mistake that it makes is that it doesn't really have a framing device that stays consistent, but also allows the Zola character to react as live commentary, as like the Twitter thread is. You're just kind of there with her. And so many shots are just sort of like Taylor Page looking blankly and not even reacting to anything. She's almost like she's, you know, vacant a little bit. And I don't know that really works for what this movie's trying to accomplish, which is, It's supposed to be this like holy shit, can you believe this is real story? And I don't know that it ever gets to those heights. I mean, it's not. I don't think it's zany enough, and I also don't really. I think it's missing any kind of commentary too. I don't really think it has anything to say other than just kind of telling this story. And it's just almost nothing about this worked for me. I had a pretty bad time with it, honestly.
You know. I'm okay with a lot of it. I kind of know what I'm getting with an A24 film at this point, for better or worse. And I think this was one of those that kind of fits that formula, as you might expect, this sort of shifting perspective and kind of wild narrative and really stylized filmmaking. Again, I do agree with you, though. There's not really a lot here that shocked me. I didn't feel like anything was too crazy. especially when you when the character of Zola is already a stripper. I think that really kind of, you know, tamps down any of this sort of, you know, that a stripper would be in sex work isn't really a shock. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the line from being a stripper to being a paid escort, I don't think is one that surprises a lot of people. And I don't think it's one that necessarily needs to surprise a lot of people. I don't think that anyone's really taken aback by that. And again, the circumstances of it, like you said, don't really come across as too crazy to me either.
No. And it only starts getting crazier. But again, like, it's big crazy moment. Like, if you read the tweets, it's like, can you believe this shit is happening? And at no point does Taylor Page's character ever ever express that sort of sentiment of holy shit, I can't believe this is happening. Like, it's almost as if it's played off as if it's just another day in the life of these people. And that's not the purpose. That's not why this thing went viral. This thing went viral because, you know, people saw it as a, wow, this is a crazy, crazy story. And I think as you watch it, it just doesn't really pop in the way that I think it probably needs to.
I don't quite get it. I don't quite get it. It's weird, and it's weird for the sake of being weird, I think, because at one point the narrative shifts to Riley Keough's character's point of view, which I don't really understand what that was about.
Yeah, I don't
know. And then you've got Coleman Domingo's character, who all of a sudden like starts talking with an African accent at times. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what that's about either. It's like this weird non sequitur thing. I did like Nicholas Braun, the kind of patheticness of the character I thought was interesting, but the movie just sort of ends.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no real sort of climax or resolution here.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't quite get it. I don't quite get what the movie was going for. I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's poorly made or anything. It's just, it doesn't really seem to ever drive its point home for me.
Yeah.
Anyway, what's your grade for Zola?
Yeah, again, I wasn't into it at all. I don't really understand a lot of the positivity that's coming out of the film. So for me, it was a C-.
Wow, look at you. I'm going to give it a C+, just because I can't quite 100% recommend it. I think it looks interesting, it sounds interesting, but it just doesn't quite grab me like it should. Anyway, let's move on to our last movie, No Sudden Move.
So what's the score?
We're sending a man that works in an office to pick something up. You are part of a babysitting team watching his family while he does it.
Good morning.
Everything is normal, except...
What do you want?
Is that something you'd say? Normal Monday?
I'm gonna shoot you right now.
Can I go home now?
Wait at the house after.
What do you mean after?
Right off of your
What is going on?
What's going on, big guy?
Yeah, what are we doing?
We're following instructions. Are you helping me or are you not helping me?
No.
Dang. It's set up, man.
God called me, offering me $10,000 to turn you in. 15 for the white guy.
Think you're the only one that can make a move? I can make a move, too.
I have the keys. I like to listen to the radio.
Organized crime, like the mob.
Well, I guess that's the $64,000 question.
Knock you off of your cage.
It's been a long day. I'll put this over you so I can relax. Thank you.
You having a good time?
This is a film by Steven Soderbergh that premiered on HBO Max over the weekend. It kind of took us by surprise, or at least me by surprise, mm-hmm. that it was actually being released. But that's Steven Soderbergh for you. He makes like two films a year, and
yeah,
sometimes they're shot on iPhones. And
yeah, well, this is like his seventh or eighth movie that he's made since retiring, if you remember, back in 2013. He announced his retirement, and then months later, I think, made The Nick, and then after that, just went full back into making like 2 films a year.
This is probably his most stylized in a while, though, because a lot of his were done, like the two most recent ones, God damn it, I can't remember the name of it, the basketball one, High Flying Bird and the cruise ship one.
Let Them All Talk.
Yeah, so the High Flying Bird was shot on an iPhone. Let Them All Talk was shot on a cruise ship with like natural lighting and like almost improvised dialogue.
Yeah.
This one is a period piece, so there's obviously a little more that goes into it than that. So tell us about No Sudden Move, Cody, and what you thought of it.
Yeah, well, I think for better or worse, Soderbergh's stuff has been interesting over the last few years. I loved High Flying Bird. I really liked, you know, more than you and Jocelyn, I liked Let Them All Talk a lot. And even stuff like Logan Lucky was fun too when he made that. Side Effects is fun too. And I appreciate that he takes this really, you know, he does it under pseudonyms, but he, you know, shoots and edits his own movies as well. And this is no exception. He shot and edited this movie. And like you said, it's a period piece that's taking place in, I think, the 50s, in 50s Detroit. And, you know, again, stacked cast. You have Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro, Brendan Fraser's in it, John Hamm, David Harbour, a couple others. Kieran Culkin, as you said, there's a Succession connection there. Noah Jupe, who seems to be in everything these days. but yeah, so basically you have it's basically a crime drama where you watch it unfold and see sort of people continually trying to one up one another, and it sort of plays into themes of greed and corruption and, you know, not knowing who you can trust. And I think it does a pretty good job at doling out its mysteries and you know, you're never, I don't think, one step ahead of anyone in the movie, which I think is a smart thing that it does, is it kind of keeps you on your toes a bit. I think across the board, the performances are really great. You know, Del Toro, as usual, you know, does a lot with little, and kind of creates a really lived-in character. Cheadle's really solid. I think the my favorite part of the cast is David Harbour, who plays kind of a guy who's put upon by these guys and a victim of sorts. And he has a couple of really great sequences and scenes that are the funnier parts of the movie, I think. Mm-hmm. I actually found myself really enjoying it for the first hour and kind of enjoying watching this, you know, self-contained world play itself out, because you're clearly seeing, you know, someone behind the scenes is playing chess, and, you know, these are all pawns in a giant chess game. I think where it starts to lose steam is what the movie ends up being about at the end of the day. Because I think that it's like when the cards are out on the table and it finally reveals itself and it finally reveals what everyone is sort of like going after, and then finally like the text on the screen at the end of the movie, I'm like, really? That's what this was about? Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it's based on a true story, based on a true, not a, I mean, not that this actual heist took place, but the conspiracy that's at the heart of it was a true story, and it's like a weird business conspiracy thing.
But it's so not relevant to the rest of the movie. You know, that could have been anything at that point. But
there are little crumbs that get dropped if you and I, to be fair, I read this after the fact.
Okay.
I don't know Detroit after. I don't know, you know, 1950s Detroit that well. But there's some crumbs, you know, something about redlining, you know, black neighborhoods. That's the Don Cheadle's character talks specifically about wanting to get a piece of property back.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things that get dropped in there that hint toward other things, but you're right. It doesn't overtly play into the rest of the film.
Yeah. And you know, I think the movie, again, you know, I don't know how he fell into it or if he even enjoys it, but, you know, the Soderbergh sort of heist thing where, you know, the movie, I think, plays out again in a very heisty way. I think the music is really fantastic. And the music is from David Holmes, one of his collaborators who did like all the Ocean's movies and Out of Sight and all that stuff. And I think the music really plays into that well. I think it looks really nice. I think, you know, Soderbergh maybe goes a little far with the lenses he uses, creating like...
It's like a weird wide-angle lens.
Yeah, it's that, like borderline fisheye lens that that he's using that kind of creates weird... Like on the edges of the screen, you see kind of oddly shaped people. I think there's great, again, small performances in here sprinkled throughout. I think Ray Liotta is good, and it has... an appearance from the king of cameos, it seems these days, who's in the movie, in a part that I enjoyed, because I enjoy when he shows up unannounced in movies a lot. All in all, I think it's enjoyable. I think that the plot becomes a little convoluted in its final act, and I think that there's one thing that happens with Benicio del Toro's character where I'm like, this was too far. I don't think this movie needed that. And I actually was not super happy with the way that played out. But aside from that, again, I enjoy Soderbergh's work in this period of his career. And I like that it's a volume game for him because not everything hits. I mean, I never saw it, but The Laundromat was super poorly reviewed. You know, Let Them All Talk. I liked it a lot, but I know a lot of people did not like it a lot. And I just appreciate that he's just kind of going for it and making a couple movies a year, because I think at the very least he's an interesting filmmaker. I think that he makes interesting movies that look good, that look interesting, and he cares a lot about the craft of filmmaking. So, you know, for a movie that I had no idea was coming out until Wednesday, I think that it was one of the better ones of the pack for sure.
Yeah, you know... I watched this movie after I watched Zola, and I was curious to think like what Soderbergh would do with a story like Zola. Like, I feel like he could have handled it a lot differently in a way that I would have preferred. Not to take anything away from the director, but I think that that's kind of the twisty logic that I'm looking for in a Soderbergh movie, and I think this one has it to a point. Like you said, I think by the end of it, I was really confused as to what had happened. Look, so the MacGuffin in this movie is like the plans for a catalytic converter, which is not the most exciting thing in the world, but it's a big deal for auto manufacturers and for pollution, replacing carburetors, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a little dense in that respect that if you don't really know anything about this, it doesn't really make any sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't really, like, you're like, why, who gives a shit about the plans for an exhaust system of a car? Like, why is there murder involved and you know, or potential murder and things? So, you know, it might not be the clearest narrative, I think, that it needs to be, or as clear a narrative as it needs to be. You know, and I think, like you said, there is, like, Benicio del Toro's character has one twist, I think, too many. Mm-hmm. And I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, there's some really great performances, I think. David Harbour has, again, one of the funniest scenes in the movie. There's a scene where he's talking to his boss.
Yeah.
That I loved. I'm not going to give it away. And there's a scene we play in the trailer also with Benicio del Toro. While that scene with David Harbour is happening, he covers the woman up with the blanket so he can relax. Like, that was a really funny scene, too. At the end of it, though, I think it got a little darker than I expected. And not really sure what happened as to why certain characters ended up having the fates that they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that it all holds up at the end for me. I might need to watch it again to understand everything. But watching it through the first time, I didn't quite put everything together by the end.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Sure. I think one other thing I'll say positive about it is that I think it's paced really well. For a movie like that, you know, a period piece that could end up being a little bit tricky or getting bogged down with certain things. I think that it's paced extremely well, especially when you know that, like, there's ulterior motives going on here. I think, like I said, I think it just tries to outsmart itself one or two steps too many. And I think it needlessly complicates certain pieces of it as a result.
Yeah.
That being said, you know, again, I enjoyed it for sure.
Yeah. No, I did too. I was enjoying it for the most part throughout the whole thing. I just, when you get to the end of it, you're like, well, why did that happen? And you can't really quite put those two things together. So anyway, mm-hmm. What's your grade for No Sudden Move, Cody?
I'm going to give it a solid B.
Yeah, I'm going to go a B also. I don't think there's anything that I wouldn't recommend about the movie. And, you know, I may not have been in the best spirits. I've been sick, so maybe I wasn't paying as much attention as I should have. Kind of like this show. I've been just trying not to fucking cough on the fucking mic. So anyway, that's going to do it for this week. Next week, Cody, Black Widow.
Yeah, a movie that we have already seen.
We've already seen. I don't think we're under embargo anymore.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But we're not going to talk about it until then.
Yeah, you pervs don't get to hear about it yet.
The big return of the Marvel Cinematic Universe after 2 years off, not counting the MCU stuff on Disney Plus, but anything else next week?
I'm sure there is. I don't really know off the top of my head. Let me see. Black Widow. Yeah, we'll probably have to come back with something there. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. Well, if you want to reach us, you can email us at podcast@cinesnob.net. You can find us on Twitter @cinesnob, Facebook cinesnobnet, youtube.com/cinesnob. You'll find this episode and all the other episodes there that aren't dinged for some copyright bullshit. Yeah, hopefully this episode's there because we had a little bit of music from Summer of Soul. Anything else before we go, Cody? I'm about to cough again.
No, let's get out of here before you ruin people's ears.
All right. Well, on that note, I am Jared Kingery.
I'm Cody Viafania.
Thank you for listening to the Cine Snob podcast. To read reviews, interviews, and more, visit cinesnob.net. See you next week.